to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So, welcome everybody. Miriam's here to talk to us today about social media journalism and the changing role of journalists. Miriam is a Berkman Fellow this year. She is on the faculty at the University of St. Gallen, and she runs the Institute for Media and Communication Management at St. Gallen. Miriam,
thank you for being here. So, good afternoon, everybody. I'm happy to be here and honored to have the opportunity to talk to you. And I'm going to be talking about a topic that really is related to me in a way, for academic reasons, of course, but also for personal reasons, because I've worked as a journalist for 15 years, and sometimes the discussion, the media debate, the public debate about the future of journalism makes me sad in a way, because I think we have a lot of arguments that are around there that are not very helpful regarding journalism. And some of those are really backward-oriented and not very future-oriented. So what we do in St. Gallen right away is we are running a rather big and long-term project on social media and the impact on journalism. 2.5 years, funded by the Swiss National Fund. And we have a research team of about 6-7 people working on that project. And I'm going to be drawing on some theoretical approaches regarding the development of journalism, the transformation of journalism, but also on some data which might be hard to take in some parts, but I hope I can explain what we are trying to look at by using this data and why this is very much interesting regarding theoretical and methodological approaches to investigate in the future roles of journalism. So these are my steps going through this talk, this luncheon talk. And we might be starting just with having a look at the current discussion. I mean, if you read the Atlantic Monthly current issues, you have a really large article on how Google is going to be saving the news industry and journalism, because they finally have realized that this might be critical for their own survival, because they need content. And we have a lot of research, mostly market-driven, corporate-based research regarding how journalists work with social media. For example, 70% of journalists use social networks for reporting and other things. And we have, of course, a really, really big debate about the economics of journalism. So if you read the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, you had this very interesting article about putting a price on words, where they try to figure out what real journalism is worth these days. And I was really surprised by reading that a regular article is about $10. Yeah. So if you look at that, you can say, okay, let's figure out how we're going to be financing the Iraq, the Moscow, the New York, whatever correspondent with $10 per article. It will be rather difficult. And the other thing is that this whole debate is, in a way, tradition-driven. So they do not try to really look forward how to change journalism, to develop journalism into the social media age, but just stick to what's happening right away and how this can't cope with what's happening in the social media sphere. So what does academia do with it? In the project I was alluding to before, we of course did quite an intense literature review, and it was rather interesting that there is almost no research on a specific kind of journalism that might be a different one taking place on social media, in social media environments or on social networking sites, but they all stick to rather traditional ways of interpreting journalism and ask how might these traditions be saved in a network future. And I was really struck by some of the quotes, and I brought you some, and you see some are rather old, but some are not so old, like 3 or 4 years old. So they say that indications are that online journalists have not yet achieved parity with their traditional peers. So there is a gap between the good ones from the traditional media and the not so acquainted ones from online journalism. And it says that bloggers are likely to continue to rely heavily on reporting from traditional journalism. That's still, of course, partly true, but partly it's not true. It's also true that bloggers set an agenda in the blogosphere and on the web. It says that it is clear that audiences are not challenging the social roles of journalists. I think it's not that clear anymore if we really look at the discussion I was alluding to before. Weaver and his colleagues did this big international survey on the self-interpretation, the self-perception of journalists, and they say journalists still refer to traditional professional role conceptions, which is probably in a way true. And then another study says, in a world in which individuals were responsible for reporting, journalism would quickly be reinvented if only to stem the chaos. So the future is the chaos, and we need the journalists to cope with it. That's a very interesting and rather old a quote from 1998. But I mostly like the last one, which says increased transparency may weaken the occupation's authority as well as its specialness in the eyes of the public. And I think there is a term in it which is very interesting. It's authority. And we were discussing this in several fellows hours, I remember, that authority is, of course, something that is rather important because it secures influence in a way. It secures public perception. It secures reputation whatsoever. So authority is something journalists like to draw upon and wouldn't like so much to give up or to give away to other communicators on the web. And that might be one explanation that makes clear why the discussion about journalism is so much traditional oriented and not very much future oriented, because authority is endangered. And that's not just true for journalism. Sometimes it's also true for academia, by the way. So what we did is we wanted to find out if there is something you could really empirically prove as a transformation of journalists' roles in social media. And we used Twitter as an example because Twitter was very popular in 2009 in the first place, and it became had a rampant development of people going onto Twitter and looking how it works and using it and developing it. And we wanted to know how a sort of journalism might evolve on such a platform. So I think everybody of you knows how Twitter looks like. Somebody never used Twitter before, so I have to explain a bit more. Okay, everybody is acquainted to that. Good. And if you look at Twitter, you realize very, very quickly that it's not as easy to... Not as easy to figure out how to cope with the data. So we thought we need a very interesting event, something of public relevance. And we looked at the Iran election and the protests against the Iran elections in June 2009. In the first place, because there was some little research by the Web Ecology Project here from Boston, but also because it was a period of 3 weeks where you could set a beginning and an end, and you knew how to cope with a time in between. And then we looked at what happened on Twitter, and we realized it's really, really a lot that happened. So we decided to do a case study on a traditional journalist being active in the social media. And we took the example of Robert McKay from the New York Times. He's a freelancer working for The Guardian, working for the New York Times, Vanity Fair, different magazines. He has a blog, The Lead, as part of the New York Times blogs. And he has a Twitter account where he tweets about current affairs and things he's writing about anyhow. So this is Robert McKay, and we had another information we drew upon by a large article in The Economist from the 18th of June last year, which said that there were three journalists that who really, really were involved in the coverage of Iran using social media: Nico Pitney of Huffington Post, Andrew Sullivan of The Atlantic, and Robert McKay of The New York Times. They waded into a morass of information and pulled out the most useful bits. So we thought, okay, let's take a look using this one single case to figure out how this journalist acts in a way as a possible mediator or as a possible filter function or whatsoever in an emerging media ecosystem that Bauman and Willis presented in the first place 2005. And they figured out that journalists are a part of the whole media ecosystem, but there are lots of other parts, grassroots movements around the journalists they can draw upon as sources, and they can also get back to as audiences or public spheres they communicate with. And something like mashups arises from this system, but it's still a very properly, orderly, made-up model. And if we look a bit further, then things get much more difficult if you really look into the structures of social media, because we can see that it's not so easy, and we have lots of different gateways people can use to communicate, being communicators, being recipients, being producers, being consumers, producing mashups, using original information from sources, from mediated sources, from filters whatsoever. So I used this graph made by Social Reflection, because just to make clear that it's really a very much complicated system, especially if you want to look at it using empirical methodology to investigate how these communication or information streams really come across. So we had three questions. Sorry. It's not working because this... No, I think it's because of the adapter.
The adapter is not.
Yeah. No, it's working, but it's just flickering. No, we see. So we try to answer three research questions. First one, how can we frame the concept of influence in a social media environment? And of course, that's something that journalism is about, getting information across to empower people to make up their minds, to build an opinion, to be informed citizens. That's one of the most important reasons why we have media freedom, freedom of speech, and these things in basic law, for example, in the First Amendment. Second question, what role do journalists take in the new media ecosystem, using the example of Twitter? And the third question, is there any evidence of an intermediary function of journalists for different public spheres, different audiences on the web? Thanks a lot. Great. The theoretical background is a rather broad one. If you look at what took place regarding the analysis and research on journalism, you have quite a range of things, starting from the very simple models, as Warren Breed did it, the idea of the gatekeeper, the journalist as a gatekeeper, as Mr. Gates really putting the stuff he gets from the newswire in two baskets. One basket is for publishing, and the other one is the waste basket. So a very, very easy and simple model on an individual interpretation base. And then you have the whole agenda setting research, which is difficult in a way, because it proposes the idea that journalists influence what people do have in their minds. And then, of course, there were several other ideas how to differentiate this model, and that is not what people have in their minds, but how they might think about things journalists report about, and how they might make up their minds towards specific topics in reference to the reporting of journalists and the building of a public opinion. We took that aside because it's interesting, but it's still too simple, and we try to draw upon the whole range of opinion leadership and influence, so the whole concept that is related to these two terms. And you have, of course, the original two-step flow model that is basically found by Katz and Lazarsfeld with their People's Choice study as a part of the psychology in communication research, where they thought that information from media flows from journalists to people, and then they had to find out that it was that there were some intermediaries. They called opinion leaders, people who used media very intensely, who talked to other people very intensely, who were very well educated, savvy in a way, and they acted as opinion leaders for the opinion followers, for the mass of the people. A lot of criticism related to that model, so we have other strands of research in that regard. For example, the opinion sharing model that applies to opinion leaders linked regarding certain topics in different groups. And we have a rather new idea that is basically connected to network science and brought up by Bird. This is the concept of brokerage and closure. Tries to explain, or it explains indeed, that information travels very fast in groups, in networks, closed networks, and it's hard to relate different groups and networks to each other. So you need something like an opinion leader, a broker, that builds a bridge between different social groups in the different networks. And this is kind of an interesting concept if you want to look at how journalism might travel from the traditional way of doing their job and interpreting their occupation to a very, very modern way based on social media. So what did we do regarding this case study and regarding the role of Robert McKay? We figured out five steps of operationalization. And the first one is the question, which Twitter accounts refer to Iran in general? Then we wanted to know, how is Robert McKay linked to the different accounts referring to Iran elections and the protests? Third question, how does McKay forward the information from the sources he is related to his readers on the web? Fourth question, which of McKay's readers are interested in Iran? And how are they interested? Can we figure out if they're more or less interested? And the fifth step was, how is McKay connecting sources on Iran with his specific readership? So what we did is we collected the data in the period between 7th of June till 26th of June 2009. And we collected more than 2 million Iran-related tweets. So this is what I was alluding to before, that you suddenly look at a case study, a single case study, and you see that you have a massive a bunch of data you have to cope with to really get into this single topic. This is the difficulty that is related to Twitter. But we looked at these hashtag terms like Iran election, Nida Mousavi, and so on, and collected all these tweets, more than 2 million, from which we derived 480 Twitter accounts really related to the Iran election topic. Then we looked at which of these accounts had the most tweets and the most retweets to figure out what are the 200 most active users. And from these active, most active users, we tried to derive the 100 most relevant users by using keyword analysis. So at least one Iran election-related keyword had to be in the tweet. Then we assumed that it was strongly related to the Iran topic. With this database, we tried to find out how McKay is linked to the different accounts referring to Iran. And I hope that some of these pictures that, of course, can be criticized might be helpful to understand what's happening. We see in this picture that McKay has chosen 12 highly relevant Iran Twitter sources. So this is what you see here on the right-hand side. The green dots are the original sources from Twitter, and there are some media sources, of course, as well. And this is Robert McKay, who is related to the different sources directly, and also related, of course, to his colleagues at the New York Times, you see in blue here in the network. So he has a specific range of sources, original Iran sources he's using for his communication stream, information stream. And then we wanted to know, how does he shape this information stream? And we looked at his New York Times blog, The Ledge, and we looked at his Twitter stream. And we found out that he's doing something a lot of people do, interconnecting the streams. So whenever he tweets something, it will appear on his blog, and whenever he posts something on his blog, it will appear on Twitter as an information that there is new information on his blog. So there's a mutual relationship between the two outlets in a way. He perfectly uses to get his information across, to disseminate new information. How does Robert McKay forward the information from the sources he uses to his readers? We looked at his blog intensely to answer that question, and we did also something like a qualitative content analysis, because we had to understand how he uses the source, and we could find a lot of indications that he uses his blog for critically discussing the sources from Iran. So he makes clear that this is not originally researched information, but that this is a Twitter information he gets across to his readers, but you have to be in a way careful to use the information, because nobody really knows about validity and credibility and these things related to the different sources he's using, though he tries to use only those sources that are more or less reliable in his way of interpreting the things. And we saw that almost 60% of his Iran-related blog entries show mentions of Twitter users. So also content-wise, he very much combines the different platforms and information streams with each other. Next question, how interested are his readers, the McKay readers, in the Iran topic? And we wanted to find out whether there are not interested readers, interested or more or less interested readers. And that's what happened to appear in answering that question. So you have a lot of not so much interested readers in the public sphere of people using Robert McKay's Twitter stream. We have interested and we have very much interested readers. And the basic interest we calculated by using keyword count. So the more keywords were in the Twitter streams or the tweets of the different people, the more interested they were related to the number of tweets they posted. And you see that there is quite a range of people being very much interested in the whole topic, again being connected to Robert McKay here in the middle. And of course, there's also a range of people not interested or just a little interested in what's happening in Iran. And the most interesting thing, I think, for the whole question of social media journalism and the change of journalism is the question, how does Robert McKay, in this case, connect the sources on Iran with his readers? And are there any differences between the very much interested and the not so much interested readers? So that's what we found out regarding this question. There is a very interesting difference, and that's something I think a lot of research could draw upon to try to develop the idea of social media journalism for different public spheres. What we can see is that the light green dots are the Iran sources. Then we have a bunch of Iran interested readers in light blue here on the right hand side, and we have a smaller bunch of very much interested readers in the dark green on the bottom of this little graph. And the interesting thing is that a lot of readers very much interested in Iran do connect directly with the sources coming from Iran. So they don't need the journalist. That's the basic line that's a result for this question. They don't need the journalist, they don't need the intermediary, they just look at the sources themselves. While all those people being interested, but not very much interested, being not an expert in a way regarding this topic, rely on Robert McKay and his information stream, are connected to him as a mediator, as a filter, as an aggregator, a broker, however you want to call that. Last idea. The question, how is Robert McKay connecting to his specific readership at the New York Times? And again, this is very interesting, because what you can see here is he has a bunch of people being interested in Iran and being connected to the sources from Iran via his Twitter stream. This is Robert McKay, and there are two others, which is Brian Stelter and Michael Luo, who are also relevant as an intermediary for the journalists. And this, again, is, in my opinion, an interesting idea to work upon or to work with for further research, that apparently in journalism, there are two different groups, or there are different groups in general, and a few people act as intermediaries for their own colleagues at a specific medium, for example, the New York Times, while others rely on the information. These people just rely on the information they get from a colleague they assume is very good informed and very much into what's happening in Iran in this case. So let me wrap up the results a bit. We investigated 480,000 Iran Twitterers and extracted the 100 most relevant Twitter sources contributing in a wider range to the topic Iran elections, protests against Iran elections. Robert McKay was our case because of the reasons I tried to point out before. He himself chose 12 highly relevant Iran Twitter sources to make up their his information stream on his blog and on his Twitter account. Almost 60% of his Iran-related blog entries show mentions of Twitter users as sources, so it's very much interrelated, the different two platforms. He uses his blog to post about Iran topics and then links to the postings of Twitter and vice versa. And based on keyword count and keyword usage, his Iran-interested Twitterers can be categorized into interested and very interested readers, and the very interested readers do not need him. They don't need a journalist intermediary. They just use the sources directly connect to the sources, while the medium-range interested readers don't do that. They rely on the information the journalist is providing them, and this might be a very interesting way of thinking about changing roles of journalists in social media. And the second very interesting idea is that there seem to be journalists who are in a way intermediaries for their journalist colleagues at a specific medium also. For example, in this case, for the other New York Times journalists being interested in Iran or working on Iran. Of course, we have to keep in mind that such a research has a lot of limitations and practical problems. I was talking about the wide range of data you have to cope with. There is not so much open access software you can use to analyze these things. So for some of these research steps, we had to code a single approach how to analyze the Twitter relations, which took a lot of time and was rather difficult. But nevertheless, if you take a single case and keep in mind that a single case is a single case, it might nevertheless be interesting to see that one journalist, in this case Robert McKay, develops different ideas or different ways of communicating with people in social networks that might be very much related to changing ideas of social media and the role journalism plays in social media. So I could hope that this could be an argument in the discussion about the future of journalism, that you go away from always stick to the traditional ideas, what journalism is about and what journalism wants to stay, but to figure out what journalists can do to use their position, their credibility, and their role as broker or filter or whatever, intermediary, to get people involved in social media information and communication streams. And there we have an example how this might be working out for journalists, being able to play the different platforms and to be relevant on the different platforms. In terms of methodology, it's rather difficult to say whether this is a study that can be drawn upon in like 5 or 10 years. I don't know about that yet, because of course it's a way of doing trial and error, using methods to understand social media information streams. And we try to be very, very serious about that. But nevertheless, of course, that's critiquable. And you have a lot of ideas maybe that how you could develop that methodology and find other ways of approaching this topic. To conclude, I would nevertheless try to derive some ideas for the changing roles of journalists in a social media environment. And that is probably like having something like different application and features you can just have let pop up. So you can be able to act on different platforms. That's probably one of the ideas that a lot of journalists do not like so much if they think about their future. But if we take it a bit more serious, I think there are three criteria that might be very, very interesting to further discuss and think about. The first one is that there is something like an audience on social media platforms you have to develop as a journalist. It's not just there, but you have to develop it. And journalists can gain such audiences in different public spheres. They might be very different and not comparable, but they can gain these audiences and serve as intermediaries to overcome social gaps between these audiences and connect people. And this is a very important role they could take in a changing media ecosystem that is, of course, related to the idea we have regarding traditional journalism, but nevertheless has changed from that idea. The only thing we have to keep in mind, and there is some other research handling or dealing with that topic, the size of an audience is rather irrelevant. So if we try to figure out that a lot of followers on Twitter might show that you're an important and well-read journalist, that's not true. So the size of audience doesn't tell about influence or something like that. There is no causal relationship between the two. So if we look at the second criteria, interactivity, that might be more interesting regarding the concept of influence I was talking about in relation to our theoretical approach. Journalists have to, of course, to get involved with their sources. That's something that some journalists still don't like to do so very much. And they have to get involved with their readers on different social networking platforms. And the amount of interactivity might indicate that journalists provide relevant content. For example, if you're retweeted well with some information you post on Twitter, it might be an indication for pass along value of the respective content you provide to other people, which means using a Twitter posting by other people is probably based on the fact that they think the information is relevant, interesting, humorous, whatsoever. And so there is sort of a value in that that's related to the interactivity and, for example, on Twitter, indicated by such things like retweets. And the third criteria is something like reputation. And if we look at that, that's maybe one of the most difficult but also interesting ways of thinking about a changing role of journalists. Because a lot of journalists have drawn upon the reputation of their media institutions. So if you wrote for the New York Times, you were just part of the New York Times, period. You didn't have to care about individual reputation. And this seems to change very much on the social media platforms and in the social media networks. Journalists need to develop an individual reputation independent of their news organizations. And this individual reputation allows for something I would describe as a personal branding. And this personal branding is related to validity of content and credibility to the person. And on Twitter, it might be indicated by mentions, for example. So if you post information on Twitter, tweet information, and a lot of people use that information and relate to you by mentionings, then that indicates that the person and the name of the person as a source of the information might be relevant in the social network and in the information stream. And this is a way of building reputation in a very specific social media environment that, of course, has other processes and shows other processes and structures than we know from the traditional media. So these might be three criteria journalists could draw upon to discuss how they develop their own occupation, their profession, their ideas of their own profession, and how to get it transformed in a way they don't lose all the authority they would like to keep, and probably a society also needs still today, but they transfer some of these concepts of authority into the social networks by really working with the structures and the information processes on the social networks and relating to these three criteria: audience, interactivity, and reputation. So that was my input for you, and I'm happy to take questions now. Yes, please.
The first one was just with reputation. So how does the mothership, let's say, of the writer, let's say the New York Times, somebody who's so embedded in that organization and they want to develop an independent voice, independent audience, how does the mothership deal with those kinds of issues? It's almost like IP or something, in my mind anyway. So that's the first question. The second question, in terms of the Iran Twitter and retweets, funny how our language is changing, but did the government, how did you engage at all with any kind of readership, study of the readership from government, or was that really opaque? Did you not know? I would be curious how the government engaged with this whole Twitter campaign. So those are my two questions.
Yeah. We did not directly engage with this government issue, but what we did is that we alluded to that before, that we did some qualitative content analysis, because we had to find out whether there were sources, apart from the evaluation by Robert McKay, whether there were sources where we had to be careful about how to evaluate them. And there was, of course, a lot of discussion on the different websites and on Twitter about what sources are reliable and what sources might be intruded by the government. So that was a lot of work to do, and we did that. So that I think, I hope, in these data, we do not have like intruded Twitter streams where government information was provided.
And they didn't try to break it down. The government did not try to censor it, the Twitter.
No, for that period, not. They started to try to do that with different platforms after a while, because and they, of course, they chased people and all that. I mean, you have a lot of tweets where people discuss where to gather, where to build up a little movement, a protest on the streets, and where you can see that people vanish. Sources just vanish because the people are apparently arrested, have been arrested, and things like that. So it's a very, very difficult thing. The other question, what about the motherships? That's interesting. I think an intelligent answer from the perspective of the mothership would be, if you have somebody like Robert McKay being evaluated by international press for his role on Twitter regarding the Iran election and protests, then it should be something good for the reputation of the mothership also. I think the New York Times, they, as far as I know, didn't communicate something like that, but they have started to realize that. So drawing upon the reputation individual journalists build up on the web, in social networks, and having them related back to the brand of the mothership is also something to think about journalism in Web 2.0 environments differently than we have done that before, where the brand of the institution was the only thing that was or the thing that mattered most, in a way.
So it seems like there's a very hopeful way to look at this picture, which is to say, we've got the emergence of figures who might be very effective bridges between one community of media practice and another community of media practice. There's another way to read it, which is to say, this is potentially a very dangerous development, which is that if that bridge is not competent to do the job that they're doing, you have the possibility that someone has a great deal of power and an enormous amount of authority. Now, as it happens, 3 weeks after your study ended, Robert McKay wrote a story on The Lead in which he accused a good friend of mine who is in prison and remains in prison in Iran of being a government collaborator. It was a spurious accusation. It was dangerous. It was insulting. It was dreadful.
Yeah.
And the reason that McKay made this is because one of his 12 informants is an Iranian source in Switzerland who hasn't been in the country for many, many years, who happens to be a conspiracy theorist, who happens to have a strong dislike of this individual. And McKay, by the way, after I and others complained about this, retracted the story, but not until it had been circulated through the New York Times. So I would point out that McKay is dealing with a very limited set of sources. He doesn't speak Persian, so he's mostly dealing with expatriate sources who are not in Iran. And with the enormous authority of the New York Times behind him, is able to say, allow me to digest 480,000 sources for you and come up with the ones that you actually care about. Whereas, in fact, what's actually going on is a journalistic process where he's able to access the 12 of which that he believes are somewhat credible based on his own biases and his access to it, and then is able to amplify it further. So I guess what I'm curious about is, how do we get from the sort of really skillful quantitative analysis that you've done here to look at actually some of those real sensitivities around the fact that when you create someone who is now a super gatekeeper, what you basically, I mean, I find this wonderful, wonderful research, but the implications of it profoundly disturbing, because what you actually seem to be suggesting is that the New York Times as a whole is relying on McKay and two others, and we know that McKay gets it wrong sometimes, and that they are literally the way that the New York Times finds out about this online conversation, which was so embraced and so thoroughly celebrated as part of this whole dialogue.
Yeah. Very, very important intervention, and I would just subscribe to everything you were saying. The first thing is, what we did, just to make that clear once again, is in a way a structural analysis of influence. So apart from the fact that we looked by using qualitative content analysis into the blog and into the tweets, you nevertheless have exactly that problem you can't solve by just taking a period of 3 weeks, which was the most rampant period of those protests, and analyzing them. So conceded and no objection to that. The other thing is, Robert McKay was probably not the most influential guy in the whole thing. If we look at Andrew Sullivan, for example, we will have a much broader scale of potential influence. We looked at him and we decided not to take him because the amount of data was just couldn't be handled in a way, because he really draw from YouTube quite a lot. He did it in a very nicely way on his blog, but there again, you could start to think about what do you know about that? And in fact, I think the sources for the mainstream media on an international level were very much related to a few journalists exactly taking that position. And of course, that's dangerous. The other thing, or the only hopeful thing, I would like to stick to give a counter argument is, it became clear that Robert McKay made mistakes, the example you were talking about. It was discussed that these mistakes happened. So there is something like a crowdsourced evaluation in a way sometimes where things become public.
When something ends up in the New York Times with the New York Times header on it saying this person's a government spy, it's hard to crowdsource around that. And so I guess that's just my worry in this. You're right to point out that Sullivan ends up being another gatekeeper. And I think you've done fantastic work sort of documenting how these gatekeepers act as bridges between these different spheres. What's so tricky about it is that these gatekeepers are hyper-empowered by their brand affiliation. And there's this, you know, when they put something out, it probably has more authority. What was interesting is when I called McKay on this, he basically said, hey, I'm just a blogger. You know, I just report rumors. I'm not part of the New York Times. Yeah. And, you know, the answer is, of course you're part of the New York Times. When you say this in the New York Times, you have a very, very different
That's interesting.
Authority.
I didn't know that, yeah.
The nice thing about McKay, and I will say this to his great credit, is that I called him out, and he had a full exchange with me in my comment thread. So it's all documented. And he didn't back-channel at all, which I greatly appreciate. So the whole thing is visible and on blog and so on and so forth. And you can go through and see if I'm overstating or not. But what worries me is that, to me, it seems like if the New York Times is going to position itself as the paper of record and the authority in this space, and it's going to do this bridging thing. Wouldn't it be great if someone spoke Persian?
Of course.
That just seems insane. I mean, literally, you could not report on the Iranian Revolution correctly if you don't speak the language, because you missed the 40%+ of Iranians who thought the revolution was being sponsored by the U.S. or the U.K. And so I guess I'm just hoping that one of the things that comes out of your work on this, and this is in no way meant as a critique of your work, and, you know, you had the misfortune that I have unfortunately had to cross swords with this guy.
But it's not a misfortune. It's great.
The people who you're documenting are incredibly powerful in this new media ecosystem. We've all woken up to this notion that there could be something very important going on in social media. What you seem to be suggesting is that the vast majority of professional journalists at the Times, including the people who might have the Persian and such to go in and do this, are not going to go and wade into Twitter. They're going to rely on these gatekeepers. If those gatekeepers are not qualified to do that work, if they are merely the most enthusiastic or the most passionate, you know, it's possible that someone like McKay, well, now Sullivan's a better example, right? Sullivan jumps on the story because it fits certain aspects of his agenda and narrative. And so he becomes that gatekeeper, but he's not transparent by any means. He's highly agendaed within that role. So I guess what I worry about is that you seem to be talking about the emergence of a new class of very, very powerful gatekeepers who have a great deal of influence and control over the story based on what their capabilities and their agendas are. And I hope that, that that's one of the implications that will come out of your work.
Maybe just one question back to you. Was it so much different before we were talking about social media? I mean, if you look at foreign reporting in former times, you had the correspondent, wherever it was, reporting about a riot, protests, elections, torture, whatever. And I can't generalize that, but I've worked in that field for 15 years, and what I often happen to realize is that foreign correspondents were sitting in their apartment having some stringers bringing the material, for example, for television, editing it without having ever seen what was happening, ever talked to anyone of the sources, and just getting across like a 7-minute reporting, like having been at the location, talking to people, in the same way using the brand of the media.
The question is whether social media lowers the bar even further.
That's it, exactly.
So here's the quote that sent me ballistic and that lost me 3 days of my life on this particular structure, right? So he writes a story that the purpose of the story is to say Iranians are getting more paranoid. And his example of how Iranians are getting more paranoid is that they're saying that Darakhshan, who mysteriously disappeared, of course the answer was he was thrown in Evin prison, is working for the government. Then he goes on to write this wonderful line. While there is no evidence to support the rumor that Mr. Darakhshan is cooperating with the authorities in their battle against Iran's opposition bloggers, and the people running the online campaign to free Mr. Darakhshan vehemently deny this rumor, he added that after I yelled at him, the fact that some Iranian bloggers are talking about this possibility seems to indicate that the cyber army set up by Iran's Revolutionary Guard has helped stir up paranoia and fear in that community. This rumor, which I cannot support or substantiate in any way, seems to suggest that people are spreading rumors in fear. And so my worry with this is that that brings the bar yet lower. And I agree that the bar was already low to start with, but my worry is essentially implicit in the message of someone like McKay is, here's this space, it's filled with innuendo and rumor, I'm going to work in and do my careful work picking the 12 sources out of the 480,000, and I'm going to try to bring clarity to this muck. But my clarity, by the way, is to say, here's the hot rumor that everyone is talking about, which I can't verify because it's coming to me from a Swiss person who hasn't been on the ground in their own country for 5 years. So I'll stop. But
Can I ask both of you? I mean, those are obviously relevant issues, but what's the solution? I mean, the solution to either of those things is to limit the freedom of what's going on.
The solution is to hire better, more qualified people to investigate in this space the same way you investigate everywhere else. If you're going to have a serious Middle East correspondent, that person speaks the language.
And knows
who those sources are.
I think there's I have a question which may get at another part of this. You talked about the readers and how they went to direct sources. Did they go to those direct sources after McKay turned them on to them, or did they go to the direct sources before? So was he giving them an access to his sources, or are they finding their own sources in a different way?
Well, we found out that there are two groups, a group of people very much interested in Iran. They never used the Twitter stream of Robert McKay. They directly connected to the original sources and communicated with them. There was a group of medium-range interested people, and they relied on the Twitter stream and the blog of Robert McKay and used the information he like filtered and got across for them. So the two are different groups. It's not a question of getting first to original sources and then to Robert McKay, but to be interested or less interested and using a journalist as a source, or using the original sources directly and exclusively.
Uh-huh. I didn't realize that, you know, the person you're describing here doesn't have any knowledge of Farsi. That strikes me as very telling that you know, how can he be an intermediary between original sources if he can't read the original sources? Or is he have like a whole staff of translators that's working for him so that he can read the original sources?
Because he, of course, had really a lot of stuff in English. Because people acting as sources in the protests wanted the world to read their stuff, so they used English as the basic language.
Right. That's still not quite, quote, original source, because, you know, it's only when they're communicating, you know, among themselves, they're doing it in Farsi. So what they're putting out in English is not necessarily what's really going on in some sense.
Well, that's just an assumption. You would have to prove that via comparing the Farsi sources to the English sources. I'm not sure whether this is true. I would doubt that there is such a difference. But I have to admit, of course, if you want to have the whole picture, you needed to analyze. And that's the same problem you find in academia, because we do not speak Farsi too. We just took the English language sources from Iran. And you also would have to analyze, of course, the sources in Farsi. That's, of course, something that's needed too.
I also want to know if his role as a gatekeeper would be, and his role as a gatekeeper and in this Twitter universe would be different if the events he were covering were in a country where English was much more widely spoken, let's say India.
That's a completely hypothetical question. I mean, could be, but I think the protests got a lot of international attention. So I'm not sure whether we can like compare something. English is spoken in Iran, of course, as an important language. So I don't know, just hypothetical. Yeah.
Is this Times blogger's work subject to the same level of editing scrutiny that an on-the-ground staff foreign correspondent would be subjected to?
No, of course not. If you're a foreign correspondent, you should be able to visit the places where things happen, to talk to people, to get quotes, interviews with people involved in the things.
I don't think I was clear. I mean, once the writing is done, your editors in New York who pass over the copy of the foreign correspondence and will throw things back, throw things out, edit, yeah, I would hope delete the sort of sentence that Ethan called out. And I'm just wondering if McKay's work is subject to that sort of review.
No, of course not. That's exactly the difference Ethan was alluding to and talking about the level that is lowered on the social networking sites, because you basically can blog about everything and you're not like evaluated, controlled by professional features that you have in a regular newsroom, for
not
example.
Not even at the Times.
No.
You know, bloggers,
no.
Blogger. This guy's a blogger with the Times' name. If I were an editor of the Times, or a top editor, I would be very concerned about the impact on the reputation of the Times that comes from the sort of sloppiness?
Yeah, well, it depends a bit, because if you start to implement the same restrictions and processes you have in regular newsrooms on the blogosphere won't be different anymore from regular news outlets, and that's probably not what they are supposed to be. Andrew Sullivan once said, I like that quote very much, blogging is writing out loud. So it's very spontaneous, and it's very individual, it's very subjective in a way. But of course, nevertheless, nothing should happen like accusing somebody of being a spy without really having the proof of that. That's the danger that is, in a way, empowered by the lower level of control and checks and balances you find on the blogosphere and on the social networks.
Just one note on raising and lowering the bar. Back in the original Iranian Revolution, apparently we didn't have a single Farsi speaker in the entire American embassy. So how could they know what was going on?
Yeah, that's just a good example for the problem we are talking about, which is not just related to social network sites, but it's related to journalism, it's related to public diplomacy, to political relations, to the work of a lot of institutions, and so on. But that's, of course, it's a pity, because if you really want to get into some culture of a country, you need to speak the language. Otherwise, there's no doubt you won't ever be able to do that. Yeah.
Did you look at your very interested readers? Are any of them journalists, either traditional or new media, or playing a gatekeeper role themselves?
Yeah, I don't have the number now here, but there are a bunch of them are journalists and media people. Yeah.
It's interesting to think about whether this model that you're putting forward, which again I really like and I think is very well documented, is the product of a moment in time. Mm-hmm. McKay functionally is a journalist whose beat is Twitter. So, I mean, if you look at his blog, The Lead, it basically says, here is some aspect of global politics. So right now he's writing about Iceland. Yeah. But his real territory is Twitter. It's not Iceland, it's not Iran, it's not anywhere else. You can imagine a moment in time at which it made sense to have a television reporter for the New York Times. And that was sort of a moment in time at which it was such a new and strange emergent medium. And then eventually it became part of the media sphere. And then you wouldn't cover how television was covering France. You'd cover France. And how television covered France would be part of that. Mm-hmm. So I wonder in some ways if maybe what you're doing is documenting a transitional model, which is to say that five or 10 years from now, the notion of sources from Twitter won't be remarkable anymore. It won't seem innovative for the New York Times to have functionally a Twitter correspondent. Twitter will just be one of the other inputs in it, and you'll have rules about it in the same way that you would use an anonymous source or a source that you'd never heard from before, mm-hmm. and bringing in your source from Twitter would be subject to that same sort of scrutiny. So that's one piece of it. Mm. The other piece of it is this question that Tom was asking, which is, what's going to happen? Is the New York Times moving in the right direction or the wrong direction in sort of having this New York Times branded, much less editorially controlled journalism coming out under a New York Times brand?
That's what I was talking about.
I would not have been screaming at McKay if he were writing this at mckay.typepad.com.
Yes.
Right. It's the fact that it had a New York Times header on it, making it very easy for someone to say the New York Times reports that Hossein Darakhshan is an Iranian spy. And on the one hand, I've been one of the folks complimenting the New York Times on embracing this and getting newer and faster, up until the moment where it looks like someone gets hurt, at which point it gets very easy to sort of pull out the torches and scream at them. So I wonder whether that's also a transition, whether we'll see in general media just get faster and sloppier, and I hope correct itself better, or whether this is a moment in time where the New York Times says, we'll try this, but then at some point sort of says, this is actually way too dangerous, we're not going to keep doing this.
Well, two parts of the answer. I think I would still stick to the opinion that the New York Times should do that. So that such flaws, really bad flaws, happen doesn't mean they do not have to engage in that. They just have to think about better ways of checks and balances. So that would be the solution, in my opinion, to cope with the problems that arise on social network sites. But nevertheless, they have to embrace it, because I don't think it's a thing that comes up a year or two and then it will be gone. Nevertheless, I think we are talking about a permanent period of transition at the moment. Mm. So if we look back 10 years, what was about blogs? What did we think about blogs and things? Very, very innovative, very new, very crazy. Now it's just regular stuff. Yeah. Everybody is reading every day. So, of course, that is just a blink in time, in a way, a spotlight analysis. And once again, what we wanted to do is to try to figure out whether there are some structural developments that might relate to specific roles of journalists. They just don't know about themselves, and they don't talk about themselves. Instead, they just talk about why their occupation is dying and nobody needs them mm-hmm. anymore. And that was a reason for looking at that. And I think there are some clues in that research where you could move ahead while taking into account that you need also mechanisms of checks and balances, control, whatever, in these networks, if you really want to be sure that something like that doesn't happen.
I just think I've worked at the BBC for many years, and as from an inside institution, that one feels that one is groping, one is sort of feeling one's way to how you maintain that you have the brand, and the BBC represents a certain informational brand, while at the same time allowing correspondents. It's different from the K because these are full-time correspondents who are employed full-time by the BBC, I guess that, but who are allowed to have their blogs. And a lot of the top correspondents at the BBC do have their blogs. And so there are different models that are being tried to see, to you know, whether the copy is read by an editor or whether there's just, the copy goes out, but then editor immediately gives feedback so that there's actually an opportunity straight away to correct, even though it's gone out before. I mean, there's been quite a lot of discussion precisely on this whole issue within the BBC. So I don't know, and I think it's been, nobody has the answer yet.
No. Yeah.
Because we're so used to quite a top heavy and for good reason, check and balance. And that's what you don't want in social media, but you still want to maintain that.
The answer, what we just heard over here, you need to fire all the journalists, basically, is it? You know, the journalists are there, the foreign correspondent is there because of a reality of the way information was moved around. You had to have somebody who could go in a canoe down the river, put the, bit of paper in his cleft stick and mail it back to wherever it was, you know what I mean? That's gone now. So
I don't think
you're
so.
You're saying there's no skill.
Just putting it out there actually is a discussion.
No, because no, I wouldn't agree.
But my point is, it's just to wrap up. What I think you just said is, these people got credibility because they worked for the New York Times. They went all around the world. Blah blah blah. Well, why not have someone at the New York Times simply find the right person in Iran and use him instead?
Conveniently, I run that company. It's called Global Voices, and it has a network of people in countries like Iran who speak Persian and who translated the Persian language blog post, which if anyone in this country had bothered to read, would have demonstrated that there was a large plurality, if not majority, of Iranians who thought the revolution was mostly being put together by a bunch of spoiled English-speaking rich kids in Tehran who knew nothing about what was going on in the streets, and that there was widespread support for Ahmadinejad, which you would only find out if you read Persian. So we, in fact, produced this. We put it out under Creative Commons so that anyone, including high-quality news organizations like the BBC, can use it for free. For whatever reason, it has surprisingly little traction in the United States, particularly when you have a story that essentially emphasizes everyone's neoconservative prejudice that an Islamic government inherently is going to cramp down on its foes, and that a few brave English-speaking, telegenic activists would like to overthrow the entire thing. But for whatever reason, we had a lot of trouble getting people to pay attention to that storyline.
That's not just a right-wing thing. It's also somewhat of a liberal thing.
It's a neoliberal thing as well. I'm sorry, and that was intended as a rant, not as a serious response. But the point is, yes, I've been building that for 6 years. No, I am not having a lot of luck with that. People are really attached to this model that someone from the New York Times, with the New York Times badge, who understands the New York Times readers, is the only one who can tell the story to the New York Times audience.
I have a contradiction to that. I think, I'm not sure whether this is true, but it might be that you need to be very rude on getting and disseminating the information. If you look at, for example, this guy, Andrew Breitbart, yeah? And what he's doing, and I just looked at him very closely because he was at the Harvard, at the Kennedy School of Government, and it was really, really interesting to listen to so-called talk he gave. There was nothing in it, but it was like a jumping around and screaming around for like 1 hour and accusing everybody of being leftist, including this university. But he is, in a way, successful getting his messages across because he's just so shameless and rude in doing that that everybody can't cope and has to deal with it in a way, at least sees it or hears it or whatever. And he makes it into the New Yorker, he makes it into Wired, he makes it into Time magazine with big articles, and you think, hey, what are they doing about this guy? So it might be a question of, I would put it, you were the first person in several years who may have suggested
that I am insufficiently rude, so it's very, very rare that that particular critique is offered to me.
This is a reason for that.
You're not in Andrew's league, sorry.
So I was told we have to finish, have to get finished by 22:02. Last question.
It's a query, a question of sorts. Could the blogosphere and Twittersphere, if you could call it that, read, say, New York Times correspondents who also blog or also Twitter, could they be, in effect, in a case where the New York Times might want to crack down or clamp down or fire one of these journalists, could they be a kind of a defense league if that man or woman is doing serious work, in their opinion? Could they come to his or her rescue, so to speak, vis-a-vis the New York Times?
Again, hypothetical. I can't tell. Might be true, might not be true. Of course, you develop like leagues of friends and people supporting you on the web in a way, but I actually don't know. So, thanks everybody. If you want to read something, just a very little remark at the end. Not this. This is on the website, the charts and everything. But there is this new novel called The Imperfectionist about a newspaper over decades. And I just happened to start reading it. And if you like newspapers and journalists, it's worth reading it. It just came out. And there is a chapter about the Paris correspondent, Lloyd, whatever. And if you read the chapter, you will be reminded of our discussion we had here in lots of ways. So thank you very much and have a nice day.